Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a damn interesting week. So let's get started with our first link.
From Ars Technica, a 55-year-old software developer faces up to 10 years in prison for deploying malicious code that sabotaged his former employer's network, costing hundreds of thousands of dollars in losses. Specifically, it was a kill switch code that activated upon his termination.
Wow.
It's the dream, right? Like, that's what all the coders are like, I'm going to put this in there.
I'll burn this place down. That's everybody's goal.
Barry Milton. But in this case, it was one Davis Liu. The U.S. Department of Justice announced that he was convicted by a jury after causing intentional damage to protected computers, reportedly owned by the Ohio and Dublin-based power management company Eaton Corp. Now, he had worked at Eaton Corp for about 11 years when he apparently became disgruntled by corporate realignment in 2018 that reduced his responsibilities. And by the next year, he had planted different forms of malicious code, creating infinite loops that deleted coworker profile files, which prevented legitimate logins, caused system crashes. And Liu even named these codes using Japanese words for destruction. There was one called Hakai, and then the Chinese word for lethargy, Hanshui. But perhaps nothing was as destructive as the kill switch he designed to shut down everything if he was ever terminated. Now, this kill switch, according to the DOJ, appeared to have been created by Liu because it was named Is DL Enabled in AD, which is apparently an abbreviation of Is Davis Liu Enabled in Active Directory?
Oh, wow.
It also automatically activated on the day of Liu's termination in 2019, which disrupted Eaton users globally. Now, Eaton Corp discovered the malicious code when they were trying to end the infinite looping, causing the systems to crash. They soon realized the code was being executed from a computer using Liu's user ID running on a server that only Liu, as a software developer, had access to.
I mean, I guess at that point, you're like, I'm going to get caught and I don't care. Like, you're not even trying to hide your track.
Right, so say it's like a bank robber who decides to get his hair cut in there or something.
Yeah, right. Or if you've ever seen Home Alone, it was the wet bandit leaving leaks everywhere, right? I mean, now, according to the filing, Liu admitted to investigators he created the code causing infinite loops, but he's disappointed in the jury's verdict and plans to appeal.
I should be allowed to do this, guys.
Like... You know, according to his attorney, the quote here is, Davis and his supporters believe in his innocence, and this matter will be reviewed at the appellate level. So stay tuned, I guess.
Yeah, you know, that's not his lawyer saying he's innocent, saying he and his supporters believe he's innocent. So
Next link.
This article comes to us from space.com. It's titled, Is Our Universe Trapped Inside a Black Hole? So without a doubt, since its launch, the James Webb Space Telescope, or the JWST, has revolutionized our view of the early universe, but its new findings could put astronomers in a spin. The $10 billion telescope, which began observing the cosmos in the summer of 2022, has found that the vast majority of deep space, and thus the early galaxies it has so far observed, are rotating in the same direction. While around two-thirds of galaxies spin clockwise, the other third rotates counterclockwise. This new research suggests that there is a preferred direction for galactic rotation. It is still not clear what causes this to happen, but one explanation is that the universe was born rotating. Black hole cosmology, also known as Schwarzschild cosmology, suggests that our observable universe might be the interior of a black hole itself within a larger parent universe. It presents the idea that the Schwarzschild radius, better known as the event horizon or the boundary from within which nothing can escape a black hole, is also the horizon of the visible universe. This has another implication. Each and every black hole in our universe could be the doorway to another, quote, baby universe. This is a theory that has been championed by Polish theoretical physicist Nikodem I should be able to get this. My spouse is Polish. theoretical physicist Nikodem Popławski of the University of New Haven. In Popławski's theory, the coupling between torsion and spin becomes very strong and prevents the matter from compressing indefinitely to a singularity. He explained, the matter instead reaches a state of finite, extremely large density, stops collapsing, undergoes a balance like a compressed spring, and starts rapidly expanding. Rapid recoil after such a big bounce could be what has led to our expanding universe, an event we now refer to as the Big Bang. And personally, in my brain, I'm now thinking of it as the Big Sproing.
Right, right.
But Popławski said, it produces a finite period of cosmic inflation, which explains why the universe that we observe today appears at largest scales flat, homogeneous, and isotropic. Torsion in the gravity of an extended theory of Einstein's general relativity therefore provides a plausible theoretical explanation of a scenario according to which every black hole produces a new baby universe inside and becomes an Einstein-Rosen bridge, or a wormhole that connects this universe to the parent universe in which the black hole exists. And there's some cool illustrations in this article, if you want to look it up, of kind of wormhole-looking things. It's some nice imagery.
An artist's rendition of.
Yes, yeah. No idea how accurate it is. Probably not very. But it's nice to look at. So I believe we talked about this in a recent article about chirality of the body and everything. Like, you know, how our amino acids or our proteins, like, go left or right. Uh-huh. And it's interesting to think that, you know, maybe there could be another baby universe where they are going the other way. And the big parent universe is keeping them apart because it's a responsible parent and doesn't want both of us to explode.
That's right. You got to keep the siblings separated.
Yeah, exactly.
See, okay, but if we're inside a black hole, doesn't that mean that other stuff would be getting sucked into our universe constantly? Like, wouldn't the matter be increasing in the sum total of our universe?
Well, sure. That's what all the data centers are for, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that is what they're saying about how this theory backs up the expansion of the universe, where it's constantly expanding. And maybe that's because the boundary is the black hole and we're seeing new stuff get pulled into it. I'm not sure. I don't know the science of how something can really be inside a black hole.
But it does make a lot of sense for just the vibes these days. Like, a black hole. Oh, okay. All right.
I'm a fan of vibes-based science. I think that's the answer to a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah. You know, vibology. I mean, I will say that if you go back into kind of ancient culture's conception of the universe, I mean, especially the Platonists, they believed that the entire nature of reality was about rotation. Mm. Plato has an entire thing about, like, the cosmic animal and how it's related to, like, the rotation of the outer world against the rotation of Earth itself, the outer world being, like, space. So it's interesting to see a little bit of a rhyme there.
Mm-hmm. And look at mankind's greatest achievement, the teacup ride at Disneyland. Like, we want to spin.
Yeah. That's,
it's in our blood, y'all.
Next link.
Next link.
This comes from The Guardian. Tennessee man shot by his dog while laying in bed.
Maybe. Or maybe he just blamed the dog. The dog is innocent. Come on.
In what is only the latest instance of a kind of accidental shooting that intermittently occurs in the U.S., Gerald Kirkwood reported to police in Memphis that he and a woman were laying in bed with a firearm when his dog jumped up and inadvertently caused the weapon to discharge. A bullet grazed the top of the man's left thigh, according to the local news, WREG. They recounted how Kirkwood's one-year-old pit bull, Oreo, had gotten his paw stuck in the trigger guard of his owner's gun. Like, pit bulls, they've already got a bad enough reputation. Don't give them guns.
Yeah.
Oreo ultimately squeezed the trigger and shot his owner, whom the station and multiple other news outlets identified.
Oh, rude.
They were not going to let that guy get away with that.
Yeah, good.
The woman accompanying Kirkwood and Oreo reportedly left the home where the shooting occurred and took the gun while the wounded man was brought into the hospital in non-critical condition. Ugh. Oreo's owner and the woman, whom the station agreed not to name in its coverage, reportedly said they would be sure to engage the safeties of any guns in their home moving forward.
Wait, no, that is not the answer. The answer is don't sleep with your gun. Oh, my God.
But if they don't, how are they going to feel safe, Jennifer?
Ugh. Yeah. Okay, a little sadder. The nonprofit Brady, United States Against Gun Violence, has found that since 2019, unintentional firearm injury has been the most common type of gun injury requiring hospitalization in the U.S., where laws governing access to firearms are notoriously lax. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a 2018 study on global firearm ownership estimated that civilian-owned guns in the U.S. outnumber people, with a population exceeding 340 million. So I looked up some stats here. We're at about 500 million guns
wow.
here in the U.S. Yeah. And of all the states, where do you think Texas ranks on the per capita gun ownership?
Top 10.
Nope.
What?
We're at 14. Now, let's be very clear about these statistics. All information regarding gun ownership is largely dependent on self-reporting.
Oh, so we are number one. There's okay. just no way to prove it.
Right. And on the site, right, I went to this site and they show like, look, the percentage of firearm ownership and firearm related deaths do not correlate. Mm-hmm. But the number of guns do.
Yeah.
So Texas, California hold the highest number of homicide deaths with guns, and we have the highest number of guns. Do we have the highest number of registered owners? No.
I mean, at this point, Oreo basically owns that gun. It feels right. like whoever shot it last is the owner
That's
of
right.
it. So.
That's right.
So knowing that, knowing how many just guns there are, it's not surprising that Kirkwood is not the only person who have been shot by a pet. Richard Rehm of Fort Dodge, Iowa, reported in 2018 being shot in one of his legs with a gun that he had tucked into his waistband while roughhousing with his pit bull lab mix, Baloo. Almost blew his junk off. Sorry, I had to. And in 2019, former Louisiana State University football player Matt Branch publicly discussed how his black lab stepped on a hunting shotgun that had been placed in the back of a utility terrain vehicle on a hunting trip in Mississippi. The shotgun fired, striking Branch in his legs. He lost the leg, spent 12 days unconscious, but survived. And this is my favorite part. Branch, who was ultimately fitted with a titanium prosthetic leg, began walking again and resolved to continue hunting.
Of course he did.
It takes us three times to learn a lesson.
And he's only got one leg left. So
you're right. So jokes aside, if your pets can do that... Kids, guys.
Yeah.
Just, yeah. Put your guns away, please. Yeah.
And in the bed does not count as away. There's a trigger lock.
Right here under your pillow does not count. Yeah. On that note, next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I've got a pop quiz for you. What do you think is the world's most scientifically tested upon animal?
I mean, mice or worms or something.
Yeah, we call them lab mice for a reason, right? But the most studied animal on Earth is, according to ElPais.com, the axolotl.
Oh!
Yeah, huh. And the reason is actually pretty understandable once they explain it, because the axolotl is the only animal that can regenerate almost any part of its body that you cut off. So because humans want to live forever, we have quietly studied this animal a whole lot. And we do have a partial answer, which is that somehow, for some reason, the axolotl spends its entire life in what is effectively a larval state. This is, by definition, the time frame when all creatures, including humans, develop their limbs and all their other body parts with the use of stem cells. And the fact that they can stay in this larval state for years at a time makes them, according to 1800s French zoologist Auguste Dumouril, quote, an animal who rebels against God.
Wow.
So the hope here for scientists, of course, is that we could somehow trick our own stem cells into thinking that we're still fetuses, even though we're out walking around in the world, and gain that magical healing ability. But we might not appreciate it as much as we think, because for the axolotl, it turns out they're not a mature creature whose body thinks it's a fetus. They are truly in a larval form of themselves. And you can, in fact, force an axolotl to finish developing, at which point it becomes a really typical-looking salamander.
Huh.
Unfortunately, if that happens, we also know that the axolotl is going to die within a year. They are not robust as adults, and frankly, despite their magical stem cells, they're not actually that robust in the larval stage either. They are sensitive to loud noises, the salinity of the water, and, most critically, the temperature of the water.
They're like these little delicate Piscean fish angels. And all I can think about is that you're dancing around the reality that we've basically been slicing and dicing them more than any other creature.
Well, yeah, but we can do that because they grow back. Like, that's part of the thing is we can study them and they mostly just live through it.
No. So I guess that's what the aliens were probing us. Like, they live through it. They're fine.
Right?
They're
exactly.
fine.
Turnabout is fair play. So most axolotls will experience stress, which leads to maturity and a quick death in anything warmer than 66 degrees Fahrenheit. And that is unfortunately a lot of what this article is framed around is the fact that axolotls in the wild are severely endangered at this point, largely due to climate change, but also due to things like the urbanization of their habitats and the introduction of invasive predators. The good news is the axolotl as a whole is not in any danger because we have so many of them in captivity, as well as protected natural environments that don't technically count as wild. And despite the overall doom and gloom of the article, there's a lot of really cool facts embedded in here that could potentially convince people that the axolotl is worth saving.
Yeah.
One thing you might not know, for example, is that axolotls are extremely tasty.
Oh, no!
I'm sorry. They were already a major part of the local diet among the Mesoamerican people when the Spanish colonizers arrived in the 16th century. And they were still regularly consumed up until about 50 years ago when conservation efforts really started to become necessary. And one of the things that makes them so great in this regard is that because they are in a larval stage, they don't have any bones, just cartilage. So the whole thing is soft and juicy, and you can apparently just wrap one up in a tortilla.
Nope.
I'm not being silly, by the way. That's a real thing they describe in the article, is wrapping one in a tortilla.
Well, yeah, humans eat ortolans, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that has bones, so this is...
Right.
But if it makes you feel any better, Angie, they are carnivorous predators themselves, and in their natural habitat, they're actually near the top of the food chain. Axolotls are nocturnal hunters that will consume anything smaller than they are, and their only real threat is the occasional water snake and some types of heron. Of course, we did mention invasive predators earlier, and in this case, that is usually the tilapia fish, which will sometimes eat an axolotl, but mostly likes to eat their eggs, which is why they've been so devastating to certain populations. One of those affected populations is the black axolotl, which is native to the Xochimilco region. And scientists are especially interested in those because unlike the 16 other species of axolotl, this one doesn't mature in response to stress. You can kind of do anything to it, and it stays in this larval stage. So that in itself is something they think is worth studying. And again, these guys are not going to go extinct. You can get a pet one for like $15. It's only in the wild that they have to face things like, you know, roving gangs of tilapia. Nonetheless, there are efforts being made to refurbish the native habitats of Xochimilco, including fundraisers through the nearby National Autonomous University of Mexico, where you can adopt an axolotl in their program for just $30 a month. Or, if that's too steep, you can make a one-time $10 donation to, and I quote, invite an axolotl to dinner, which is adorable, but they had no self-awareness that just a couple of paragraphs earlier they were describing how to prepare one for dinner.
Like, be specific when you say to dinner as a guest or as the dish.
Exactly. Oh. I mean, basically, if you could get one as a pet for $15, you can get one for dinner for $15.
Okay.
Next link.
Next link.
Okay, now for something completely different. SF Gate takes us to an innocent time, the year 2005, when a Sony Bravia ad won countless awards and racked up millions of YouTube views because they let loose thousands of bouncy balls in the streets of San Francisco. Have y'all seen this?
I remember that one.
Here's the kicker. It was a British commercial. It wasn't even for our market. but what a turn back in time. It was one of the most surreal weeks in the city's history. It resulted in a short film commercial that swept the advertising award circuit and racked up a cumulative 5 million YouTube views, which for a commercial, oof. Now, you would think that such a spectacle would lean heavily on computer-generated imagery and post-production magic, but after the first ball drop on Filbert Street, the result looked so good that the Danish director sent the special effects team back to the UK Not going to need you guys. So everything that you see in that video is done in camera. Now, the frog was rigged, as they say, but the frog is real because there's a little frog that like pops out of a drain pipe at the very beginning of it. But they staged this frog by placing a plug in the drain pipe to keep the frog in place until the perfect moment. Location scout Patrick Ranahan's son dropped a handful of balls into the pipe from a rooftop as a storm of colorful spheres rushed past. He has still kept some of the balls as a souvenir. Now, this project had so many seemingly impossible logistical elements, from securing city permits to designing propulsion systems to cleaning up and repairing the ensuing devastation. But it all started with a brief prompt from the creative director, Juan Cabral, at British ad agency Fallon. And it revolved around the slogan, color like no other. So there were a ton of pitches for the commercial, including a pitch from director Spike Jonze. Now, Fool's Gig, the Danish director, he remembers his pitch as something like, it's early morning. Billions of balls arrive in a city. Billions of balls leave. Ooh. Now, he was thinking like, basketballs or beach balls, but then he landed on the idea of the bouncy ball. And he chose San Francisco as the setting because he'd been obsessed with the movie Bullet for years. And plus, of course, it's very hilly. So it was going to work very well for this circumstance. Quote, there's no other place in the world to go if you want to throw stuff down the street. It's every child's dream. Hard to argue with that. So once Fallon accepted the pitch, the reality of the logistical challenges began to sink in. So first, they had to scour the entire country to acquire 250,000 bouncy balls needed to create the critical mass that was going to be shown. Quote, they bought every bouncy ball west of the Mississippi. There was not a single bouncy ball in any machine in America for a couple of months. I felt so bad for the poor children.
Said the poor children.
Yeah, but he's Danish, so you can just hear the sarcasm dripping off of that, right? Now, even though it would be a spectacular sight on its own to just roll the balls down the hill, what he had in mind was kind of take some substantial height to take advantage of the full bounce potential of these little balls. And that was already going to be lessened because of the angled slope of a San Francisco hill. So they brought in special effects and production specialist Barry Connor to create a launch system with the caveat that someone else would handle retrieval duties. Honestly, if you're being brought on a project like that, that's where you draw the line, right? Like someone else is cleaning this up for me. Now, they rented a sound stage in Culver City to run tests, but they didn't really anticipate just how many balls they would be dealing with. Quote, they told us there's 250,000 bouncy balls coming. We thought, oh, well, it'll fill up a few carts. Then the semis started showing up. Now, to make matters even more complicated, the director came up with a last minute idea for a set piece that used only red balls, which meant they had to hire additional PAs to sort the balls by color.
Wow.
Now, to get the balls airborne, Connor came up with a proprietary mortar system. It was essentially truck-mounted cannons designed with an engineer's mindset. Now, the typical bouncy ball, which, by the way, if you've never heard what they're made out of, get ready. It's a synthetic polymer called Zectron, and it's marketed under the name Superball by toy company Whammo. Now, this has a remarkably high coefficient of restitution of 0.92. That means that if a super bouncy ball is dropped from 100 feet, it can bounce back up to 92 feet.
Wow.
Connor had physics equations, math volumes, how many balls in a tube, how far, what angle, what pressure for it to go what distance. Now, the early tests ended up destroying the balls. Whoops. They would put 5,000 balls in. They come out in tiny little pieces. They only went 8 feet. So to solve the problem, Connor's team created a foam wad connected to the cannon's hopper by a 12-foot rope. And it functioned as a kind of buffer between the balls and the air-powered force of the cannon, with the rope functioning kind of like a rocket booster. So that's just the delivery system, which was obviously a challenge. But the real trick was convincing the city of San Francisco and the neighborhood residents to permit such a disruptive shoot.
Yeah.
The director is giving accolades to the location scout, Patrick Ranahan. I really admire and have always been so grateful to him. This was by far the most difficult location managing job I've ever been involved with. The fact he managed to convince all the residents in all these neighborhoods to do this, I was very nervous about whether we were going to get a no. But according to Ranahan, when I would go into the mayor's office and say these things, they would listen. In a lot of places in the world, they won't even listen. But I worked on this Bond film, A View to Kill, the worst Bond film, and we saw Dianne Feinstein. We had this meeting. I remember asking, we want to set City Hall on fire. We want to bump a blimp into the Golden Gate Bridge. And we want to jump a hook and ladder truck over Lefty O'Doul Bridge with Roger Moore on it. And they were seriously like, okay.
I mean, if you pay enough, they'll do it. Like, they're not mentioning what's the fee for these permits. You are paying the city for this stuff.
That's true. I can tell you what they paid in restitution for damage because there was damage. Now, in addition to the mayor, the location scout also had to meet with the board of supervisors, had to warn everyone in the neighborhoods. I said to everybody on the street, we're not sure exactly what's going to happen, but whatever we destroy, we will fix it 10 times better. And to make good on that promise, the crew had a glass repair company on site with replacement window panes for the inevitable damage, like during the shoot. So, okay, the shoot. The first day of the shoot, 6 cannons were mounted on trucks, bolted into the ground at Filbert and Hyde Streets. Another 6 were positioned at Jones and Union for a second blast. Each mortar had about 25,000 balls in it. 6 cameras were ready for the shot. Each had a protective plywood casing. To use slow motion effect, they use an older photosonics camera, which made production even more complicated because it filmed at such a high speed that the slightest change in light would compromise the shoot. So they needed special weather insurance that afforded the crew an extra day of shooting if a cloud happened to move in front of the sun at a bad moment. They had built set pieces in the line of fire like that aforementioned frog drain. There was a ledge for a dog to stand on, mailboxes, garbage cans, bushes for the balls to pass through. The crew members wore Kevlar, armor, helmets, riot shields. Golf driving range nets hung at the bottom of the hill to catch stray balls. They even covered sewer drains. And then they called action. Quote, the noise it made is nothing like you've ever heard. It was like a hailstorm. You could hear them coming. They basically shredded foliage on the street. We had 24 picture vehicles, our cars, that were damaged. There's a picture within the article as well where you can see a bouncy ball lodged into a broken taillight in a car. Now, they calculated the balls reached a top speed of between 150 and 200 feet per second. That is a tasty 102 or 136 miles per hour.
And that's why they had Kevlar on.
That's right. Some of them bounced over houses to 3 blocks over. Some of them fell into storm grates that were thought to be outside the bounce radius. Yeah, San Francisco Public Works was not happy about that. Now, the speed of the balls combined with the slow motion camera, it did deliver what the director was going after. There's a shot in the commercial that they called the Aquarium of Mayhem because it was in slow motion and it looks so beautiful as you're tracking left to right. They said they were in tears looking at the footage. Yeah. But of course, in addition to the beauty, there was also destruction. Cars looked like cottage cheese. 6 houses were damaged in the crossfire. One memorable shot captured balls chipping off wooden siding. When Connor was checking into his hotel later that night, a ball bounced by on the sidewalk about 4 or 5 miles away from the shoot itself. Their bill on broken windows came to about $74,000. And the crazy thing is, everybody loved it. The people, the neighborhood, they still come out and talk to them if they recognize them from the shoot. Now, they had to do this for a few more days because this was a multi-day shoot. There were more cannon blasts, but the city was like, okay, we need to have some boundaries here. San Francisco Film Commission restricted them from using the mortars on the following day's shoots. Film commissioners quoted as saying, here's 2 things I never want to see in San Francisco again, air mortars and Barry Connor. So with the mortar systems forbidden, they used a backup plan that included filling shipping containers, then mounting the shipping containers on forklifts that lifted them 65 feet in the air, then dropping the balls onto street-level plywood ramps that would send the balls soaring. So they got more shots of all of this stuff. Now, if this happened today, the whole thing would be international news, right? But in 2005, social media was still nascent and not everyone had a camera in their pocket.
Mm-hmm.
SF Gate found no archival newspaper records, either from the San Francisco Chronicle or the Examiner. But word of mouth was enough to make this shoot absolutely legendary for all of the citizens. At one point when they were shooting, there were 50 or 60 people from the neighborhood just watching, and everybody's just grinning, huge grins. And of course, as more spectators came, the number of balls started to shrink. Despite the magical nature of the event, retrieving the balls from deep inside foliage wasn't really glamorous, but a lot of the neighbors and residents ended up helping, and many of them still have balls to this day.
Yeah, that entire series of commercials, like, they did another one where they had a really big, like, high-rise apartment building that was due to be demolished. And so they rigged it entirely with exploding paint contraptions in every room and around the back, like, on the outside. And they could only do it in one take. So it's literally just, you know, explosions of paint everywhere. And it starts with like a clown running by in slow-mo. And then, you know, this like very high energy classical music. And that series of commercials is incredible. They did an entire like massive stop motion piece in New York that like just had the public filtering in and out as they're doing the shift. And like you see the day change as they're doing all of it. Like true art, honestly, even if it's just for a freaking TV. But like really incredible.
Yeah, totally fun for everybody. Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from TheGuardian.com. It's titled Primordial Surf. Micro lightning in mist may have sparked life on Earth, study finds.
Like, so static electricity? Is that, like, how micro are we talking?
I think we're talking, like, actual lightning, but splitting out into the smallest pieces of itself. How life started on Earth may forever be a mystery, but new research proposes a radical idea that crashing waves and waterfalls may have kicked off the process by throwing up mists of water. In experiments at Stanford University, chemists discovered that micro droplets in fine sprays of water generate streaks of micro lightning. When surrounded by the right mix of gases, these sparks power chemical reactions that synthesize many molecules for life. Professor Richard Zare, a chemist who led the team, said, "This is a real contribution to understanding how you can go from non-life to life. You have water sprays all over the place, particularly around rocks, and there are crevices in rocks where these chemicals can accumulate." The idea that lightning created the ingredients for life gained traction in 1953 when Stanley Miller and Harold Urey at the University of Chicago reported that electrical discharges in a simulated early Earth atmosphere produced amino acids. But the hypothesis has its critics. Lightning is too infrequent, they say, and the chemicals produced simply drift away. Zare's team took to a dark room to investigate the electrical properties of water sprays. They found that droplets carry opposing charges, and when they come together, tiny sparks leap between them. Unlike lightning bolts that cover miles, micro lightning travels a few billionths of a meter. While the effect is faint, it carries enough energy to drive chemical reactions. Writing in Science Advances, the researchers describe how they sprayed water into a mixture of nitrogen, methane, carbon dioxide, and ammonia. This led to the rapid formation of key molecules including hydrogen cyanide, glycine, and uracil, a building block of RNA found in all living cells. Zare said, "We propose that this is a new mechanism for the prebiotic synthesis of molecules that constitute the building blocks of life." Professor David Deamer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who has worked with Zare but not on the latest study, said microlightning can now be added to the list of possible energy sources available to drive organic synthesis before life began. And I guess it is kind of like a mixture of like lightning or static electricity.
Yeah, I mean, technically static electricity is a form of lightning. I just like the idea that like if I shuffle my feet on the carpet and touch you, I might have made life between us. Like, or amino acids, you know, whatever, the building blocks.
Yeah, you know, what's friendship without a little amino acid creation, right?
Exactly.
All right, well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include one man's lifelong quest to create a lettuce cigarette, Super Nintendo hardware is running faster as it ages, and you're more likely to die if you have surgery on a Friday. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at Patreon.com/DamnInteresting Week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.